school finished on June 10th that year. 12 days later, I flew to Los Angeles. I rented a car and checked into the same cheap hotel I had used on other occasions. On each of the next 3 days, I drove into the Hollywood Hills and mounted a watch on Dolan's house. It could not be a constant watch. That would have been noticed. The rich hire people to notice interlopers, because all too often they turn out to be dangerous, like me. At first, there was nothing. The house was not boarded up. The lawn was not overgrown, heaven forbid. The water in the pool was doubtless clean and chlorinated. But there was a look of emptiness and disuse, all the same. Shades pulled against the summer sun, no cars in the central turnaround, no one to use the pool that young man with ponytail cleaned every other morning. I became convinced it was a bust. Yet I stayed, wishing and hoping for the final vector. On the 29th of June, when I had almost consigned myself to another year of watching and waiting and exercising and driving a front-end loader in the summer for Harvey Blocker, if he would have me again, that was, a blue car marked Los Angeles Security Services pulled up at the gate of Dolan's house. A man in a uniform got out and used a key to open the gate. He drove his car in and around the corner. A few moments later, he came back on foot, closed the gate, and relocked it. This was at least a break in the routine. I felt a dim flicker of hope. I drove off, managed to make myself stay away for nearly 2 hours, and then drove back, parking at the head of the block instead of the foot this time. 15 minutes later, a blue van pulled up in front of Dolan's house. Written on the side were the words, "Big Joe's Cleaning Service." My heart leapt up in my chest. I was watching in the rearview mirror, and I remember how my hands clamped down on the steering wheel of the rental car. 4 women got out of the van, 2 white, 1 black, 1 Chicana. They were dressed in white like waitresses, but they were not waitresses, of course. They were cleaning women. The security guard answered when one of them buzzed at the gate and unlocked it. The 5 of them talked and laughed together. The security guard attempted to goose one of the women, and she slapped his hand aside, still laughing. One of the women went back to the van and drove it into the turnaround. The others walked up, talking amongst themselves as the guard closed the gate and locked it again. Sweat was pouring down my face. It felt like grease. My heart was trip-hammering. They were out of my field of vision in the rearview mirror. I took a chance and looked around. I saw the back doors of the van swing open. One of them carried a neat stack of sheets. Another had towels. Another had a pair of vacuum cleaners. They trooped up to the door, and the guard let them inside. I drove away, shaking so badly that I could hardly steer the car. They were opening the house. He was coming. Dolan did not trade in his Cadillac every year, or even every 2. The gray sedan DeVille he was driving, as that June neared its end, was 3 years old. I knew its dimensions exactly. I had written the GM company for them, pretending to be a research writer. They had sent me an operator's manual and a spec sheet for that year's model. They even returned the stamped, self-addressed envelope I had enclosed. Big companies apparently maintain their courtesy even when they're running in the red. I'd taken 3 figures, the Cadillac's width at its widest point, height at its tallest, and length at its longest, to a friend of mine who teaches mathematics at Las Vegas High School. I have told you, I think, that I had prepared for this, and not all my preparation was physical. Most assuredly not. I presented my problem as a purely hypothetical one. I was trying to write a science fiction story, I said, and I wanted to have my figures exactly right. I even made up a few plausible plot fragments. My own inventiveness rather astonished me. My friend wanted to know how fast this alien scout vehicle of mine would be going. It was a question I had not expected, and I had asked him if it mattered. "Of course it matters," he says. "It matters a lot. If you want the scout vehicle in your story to fall directly into your trap, the trap has to be exactly the right size. Now this figure you've given me is 17 feet by 5 feet. I opened my mouth to say that wasn't exactly right, but he was already holding up his hand. "Just an approximation," he said. "Makes it easier to figure out the arc."
"The what?"
"The arc of descent," he repeated, and I cooled off. That was a phrase with which a man bent on revenge could fall in love. It had a dark, smoothly portentous sound. The arc of descent. I'd taken it for granted that if I dug a grave so that the Cadillac could fit, it would fit. It took this friend of mine to make me see that before it could serve its purpose as a grave, it had to work as a trap. The shape itself was important, he said. The sort of slit trench that I had been envisioning might not work. In fact, the odds of its not working were greater than the odds that it would. If the vehicle doesn't hit the start of the trench dead on, he said, it might not go all the way in at all. It would just slide along on an angle for a while, and when it stopped, all the aliens would climb out of the passenger door and zap your heroes. The answer, he said, was to widen the entrance end, giving the whole excavation a funnel shape. Then there was this problem of speed. If Dolan's Cadillac was going too fast and the hole was too short, it would fly across, sinking a bit as it went, and either the frame or the tires would strike the lip of the hole on the far side. It would flip over on its roof, but without falling in the hole at all. On the other hand, if the Cadillac was going too slowly and the hole was too long, it might land at the bottom on its nose instead of its wheels, and that would never do. You couldn't bury a Cadillac with the last 2 feet of its trunk and its rear bumper sticking out of the ground any more than you could bury a man with his legs sticking up. So, how fast will your scout vehicle be going? I calculated quickly. On the open highway, Dolan's driver kept it pegged between 60 and 65. He would probably be driving a little slower where I had planned to make my try. I could take away the detour signs, but I couldn't hide all the road machinery or erase all signs of construction. About 20 rule, I said. He smiled. Translation, please? Say 55 Earth miles an hour. Aha! He set to work at once with his slipstick while I sat beside him, bright-eyed and smiling, thinking about that wonderful phrase, arc of descent. He looked up almost at once. You know, he said, you might want to think about changing the dimensions of the vehicle, buddy. Oh? Why do you say that? A 17x5 is pretty big for a scout vehicle, he laughed. It's damn near the size of a Lincoln Mark IV. I laughed, too. We laughed together. After I saw the women going into the house with the sheets and towels, I flew back to Las Vegas. I unlocked my house, went into the living room, picked up the telephone. My hands trembled a little. For 7 years I had waited and watched like a spider in the eaves or a mouse behind the baseboard. I had tried never to give Dolan the slightest clue that Elizabeth's husband was still interested in him. The totally empty look he had given me that day as I had passed his disabled Cadillac on the way back to Vegas, furious as it had made me at the time, was my just reward. But now I would have to take a risk. I would have to take it because I could not be in two places at the same time, and it was imperative that I know if Dolan was coming, and when to make the detour temporarily disappear. I'd worked out a plan coming home on the plane. I thought it would work. I would make it work. I dialed Los Angeles Directory Assistance and asked for the number of Big Joe's cleaning service. I got it and dialed it. This is Bill at Rennie's Catering, I said. We got a party Saturday night at 1121 Astor Drive in the Hollywood Hills. I wanted to know if one of your girls could check for Mr. Dolan's big punch bowl in the cabinet over the stove. Could you do that for me? I was asked to hold on. I did, somehow, although with the passing of each endless second, I became more and more sure that he had smelled a rat and was calling the phone company on one line while I held on the other. At last, at long, long last, he came back on. He sounded upset, but that was all right. That was just how I wanted him to sound. Saturday night? Yes, that's right. But I don't have the punch bowl as big as they're going to want unless I call across town, and my impression was that he already has one. I'd just like to be sure. Look, mister, my call sheet says Mr. Dolan ain't expected until 3 p.m. Sunday afternoon. I'll be glad to have one of my girls check out your punch bowl, but I want to straighten this other business out first. Mr. Dolan is not a man to fuck around with, if you'll pardon my French. I couldn't agree with you more, I said. And if he's going to show up a day early, I've got to send some more girls out there right away. Let me double check, I said. The third grade reading textbook I use, Roads to Everywhere, was on the table beside me. I picked it up and riffled some pages close to the phone. Oh boy, I said. It's my mistake. He's having people on Sunday night. Really sorry. You gonna hit me? Nah. Listen, let me put you on hold again. I'll get one of the girls and have a check on the... No need, if it's Sunday, I said. My big punch bowl's coming back from a wedding reception in Glendale Sunday morning. Okay, take it easy. Comfortable. Unsuspicious. The voice of a man who wasn't going to think twice. I hoped. I hung up and sat still, working it out in my head as carefully as I could. To get to L.A. by 3, he would be leaving Vegas about 10 o'clock Sunday morning, and he would arrive in the vicinity of the detour between 11:15 and 11:30 when traffic was apt to be almost non-existent anyway. I decided it was time to stop dreaming and start acting. I looked through the want ads, made some telephone calls, and went out to look at 5 used vehicles that were within my financial reach. I settled on a battered Ford van that had rolled off the assembly line the same year Elizabeth was killed. I paid cash. I was left with only $257 in my savings account, but this did not disturb me in the slightest. On my way home, I stopped at a rental place the size of a discount department store and rented a portable air compressor, using my MasterCard as collateral. Late Friday afternoon, I loaded the van. Picks, shovels, compressor, a hand dolly, a toolbox, binoculars, and a borrowed highway department jackhammer with assorted arrow-shaped attachments made for slicing through asphalt. A large square piece of sand-colored canvas, plus a long roll of canvas. This latter had been a special project of mine last summer, and 21 thin wooden struts, each 5 feet long. Last but not least, a big industrial stapler. On the edge of the desert, I stopped at a shopping center and stole a pair of license plates that I put on my van. 76 miles west of Vegas, I saw the first orange sign. Construction ahead. Pass at your own risk. Then a mile or so beyond that, I saw the sign that I'd been waiting for since... Well, since Elizabeth died, I suppose, although I hadn't always known about it. Detour ahead, 6 miles. Dusk was deepening towards dark as I arrived and surveyed the situation. It could have been better if I'd planned it, but not much. The detour was a right turn between 2 rises. It looked like an old fence-line road, which the highway department had smoothed and widened to temporarily accommodate the heavier traffic flow. It was marked by a flashing arrow powered by a buzzing battery in a padlocked steel box. Just beyond the detour, as the highway rose towards the crest of that second rise, the road was blocked off by a double line of road cones. Beyond them, if one was so extraordinarily stupid as to have first missed the flashing arrow and second run over the road cones without realizing it, and I suppose some drivers were, was an orange sign almost as big as a billboard reading, "Road Closed, Use Detour." Yet the reason for the detour was not visible from here, and that was good. I didn't want Dolan to have the slightest chance of smelling the trap before he fell into it. Moving quickly, I didn't want to be seen at this. I got out of the van and quickly stacked up some dozen of the road cones, creating a lane wide enough for the van. I dragged the "Road Closed" sign to the right, then ran back to the van, got in, and drove through the gap. Now I could hear an approaching motor. I grabbed the cones again, replacing them as fast as I could. 2 of them spilled out of my hands and rolled down the gully. I chased after them, panting. I tripped over a rock in the dark and fell sprawling, and got up quickly with the dust on my face and blood dripping from one palm. The car was closer now, and soon it would appear over the last rise before the detour junction. And in the glow thrown by his high beams, the driver would see a man in his jeans and T-shirt trying to replace road cones while his van stood idling where no vehicle that didn't belong to the Nevada State Highway Department was supposed to be. I got the last cone in place and ran back to the sign. I tugged too hard. It swayed and almost fell over. As the approaching car's headlights began to brighten on the rise to the east, I suddenly became convinced it was Nevada State Trooper. The sign was back where it had been, and if it wasn't, it was close enough. I sprinted for the van, got in, and drove over the next rise. Just as I cleared it, I saw the headlights splash over the rise behind me. Had he seen me in the dark? with my own lights out? I didn't think so. I sat back against the seat, eyes closed, waiting for my heart to slow down. At last, the sound of the car bouncing and bucketing its way down the detour faded out. It did. I was here, safe behind the detour. It was time to get to work. Beyond the rise, the road descended to a long, straight flat. Two-thirds of the way along this straight stretch, the road simply ceased to exist. It was replaced by piles of dirt and a long, wide stretch of crushed gravel. Would they see that and stop? Turn around? Or would they keep on going, confident that there must be an approved way through, since they hadn't seen any detour signs? Too late to worry about it now. I picked a spot about 20 yards into the flat, but still a quarter of a mile short of the place where the road dissolved. I pulled over to the side of the road, worked my way into the back of the van, and opened the back doors. I slid out a couple of boards and muscled the equipment. Then I rested and looked up at the cold desert stars. "Here we go, Elizabeth," I whispered to them. It seemed I felt a cold hand stroke the back of my neck. The compressor made a racket, and the jackhammer was even worse, but there was no help for it. The best I could hope for was to be done with this first stage of work before midnight. If it went on much longer than that, I was going to be in trouble anyway, because I only had a limited quantity of gasoline for the compressor. Never mind. Don't think of who might be listening and wondering what fool might be running a jackhammer in the middle of the night. Think about Dolan. Think about the gray sedan DeVille. Think about the Ark of Descent. I marked off the dimensions of the grave first, using white chalk, the tape measure from my toolbox, and the figures my mathematician friend had worked out. When I was done, a rough rectangle, not quite 5 feet wide by 42 feet long, glimmered in the dark. At the nearer end, it flared wide. In the gloom, that flare did not look so much like a funnel as it had on the graph paper where my mathematician friend first sketched it. In the gloom, it looked like a gaping mouth at the end of a long, straight windpipe. "Oh, the better to eat you with, my dear," I thought, and smiled in the dark. I drew 20 more lines across the box, making stripes 2 feet wide. Last, I drew a single vertical line down the middle, creating a grid of 42 near squares, 2 feet by 2.5. The 43rd segment was the shovel-shaped flare at the end. Then I rolled up my sleeves, pull-started the compressor, and went back to square one. The work went faster than I had any right to hope, but not as fast as I had dared to dream. Does it ever? It would have been better if I could have used the heavy equipment, but that would come later. The first thing was to carve up the squares of paving. I was not done by midnight, and not by 3 in the morning, when the compressor ran out of gas. I had anticipated this might happen, and was equipped with a siphon for the van's gas tank. I got as far as unscrewing the gas cap, but when the smell of gasoline hit me, I simply screwed the cap back on and lay down flat on the back of the van. No more. Not tonight. I couldn't. In spite of the work gloves I'd worn, my hands were covered in big blisters, many of them now weeping. My whole body seemed to vibrate from the steady, punishing beat of the jackhammer. My arms felt like tuning forks gone mad. My head ached. My teeth ached. My back tormented me. My spine felt as if it had been filled with ground glass. I had cut my way through 28 squares. 28. 14 to go. And that was only the start. Never, I thought. It's impossible. Can't be done. That cold hand again. Yes, my darling. Yes. The ringing in my ears was subsiding a little now. Every once in a while I could hear an approaching engine. And then it would subside to a drone on the right as it turned onto the detour and started around the loop the highway department had created to bypass the construction. Today was Saturday. Dolan was coming on Sunday. No time. Yes, my darling. The blast had torn her to pieces. My darling had been torn to pieces for telling the truth to the police about what she had seen, for refusing to be intimidated, for being brave. And Dolan was still driving around in his Cadillac, drinking 20-year-old scotch while his Rolex glimmered on his wrist. "I'll try," I thought, and then I fell into a dreamless sleep that was like death. I woke up with the sun, already hot at 8 o'clock, shining in my face. I sat up and screamed, my throbbing hands flying to the small of my back. Work? Cut up another 14 chunks of asphalt? I couldn't even walk. But I could walk, and I did. Moving like a very old man on his way to a shuffleboard game, I worked my way to the glove compartment and opened it. I had put a bottle of Emprin there in case of such a morning after. Had I thought I was in shape? Had I really? Well, that was quite funny, wasn't it? I took 4 of the Emprin with water, waited 15 minutes for them to dissolve in my stomach, then wolfed a breakfast of dried fruit and cold Pop-Tarts. I looked over to where the compressor and jackhammer waited. The yellow skin of the compressor already seemed to sizzle in the morning sunshine. Leading up to it on either side of my incision were the neatly cut squares of asphalt. I didn't want to go back over there and pick up that jackhammer. I thought of Harvey Blocker saying, "You ain't never gonna be strong, Bubba. Some people and plants take hold in the sun, some wither up and die. Why you pulling this crap on your system?" "She was in pieces," I croaked. I loved her and she was in pieces. As a cheer, it was never going to replace Go Bears or Hook'em Horns, but it got me moving. I siphoned gas from the van's tank, gagging at the taste and the stink, holding on to my breakfast only by a grim act of will. I wondered briefly what I was going to do if the road crew had drained the diesel from their machines before going home for the long weekend, and quickly shoved the thought out of my mind. It made no sense to worry over things I couldn't control. More and more, I felt like a man who had jumped out of the bay of a B-52 with a parasol in his hand instead of a parachute on his back. I carried the gasoline can over to the compressor and poured it into the tank. I had to use my left hand to curl the fingers of my right around the handle of the compressor's starter cord. When I pulled, more blisters broke. And as the compressor started up, I saw thick pus dripping out of my fist. "Never make it. Please, darling." I walked over to the jackhammer and started it again. The first hour was the worst. And then the steady pounding of the jackhammer combined with the Emprin seemed to numb everything, my back, my hands, my head. I finished cutting out the last block of asphalt by 11. It was time to see how much I remembered of what Tinker had told me about jump-starting road equipment. I went staggering and flapping back to my van and drove a mile and a half down the road to where the road construction was going on. I saw my machine almost at once, a big Case Jordan bucket loader with a grapple and pinchers attachment on the back, $135,000 worth of rolling stock. I had driven a Caterpillar for Blocker, but this would be pretty much the same, I hoped. I climbed up into the cab and looked at the diagram printed on the head of the stick shift. It looked just the same as the one on my cat. I ran the pattern once or twice. There was some resistance at first because some grit had found its way into the gearbox. The guy who drove this baby hadn't put down his sand flaps and his foreman hadn't checked him. Blocker would have checked. And docked the driver $5, long weekend or not. His eyes. His half-admiring, half-contemptuous eyes. What would he think of an errand like this? Never mind. This was no time to be thinking of Harvey Blocker. This was a time to be thinking of Elizabeth. And Dolan. There was a piece of burlap on the steel floor of the cab. I lifted it, looking for a key. There was no key there, of course. Tink's voice in my mind. "Shit. A kid could jumpstart one of these babies, white bread. Ain't nothing to it.
At least the car's got an ignition lock on it. New ones do, anyway. Looky here. No, not where the key goes. You ain't got no key. Why you want to look where the key goes? Looky here. See these wires hanging down?
I looked now and saw the wires hanging down, looking just as they had when Tinker pointed them out to me. Red, blue, yellow, and green. I pared the insulation from an inch of each, and then took a twist of copper wire from my back pocket.
Okay, white bread, listen up, because maybe we're going to give a Q&A later, you dig me? You're going to wire the red with the green. You won't forget that because it's like Christmas. That takes care of your ignition.
I used my wire to hold the bare places on the red and green wires of the Case Jordan's ignition together. The desert wind hooted, thin, like the sound of someone blowing over the top of a soda bottle. Sweat ran down my neck into my shirt, where it caught and tickled.
Now you just got the blue and the yellow. You ain't gonna wire 'em. You're just gonna touch 'em together, and you're gonna make sure you ain't touching no bare wire with yourself when you do it, neither. Unless you want to make some hot, electrified wadding your old jockeys, man. The blue and the yellow ones turn the starter. Off you go. When you feel like you had enough of a joyride, you just pull the red and green wires apart, like turning off a key you don't have.
I touched the blue and yellow wires together. A big yellow spark jumped up and I recoiled, striking the back of my head on one of those metal posts near the rear of the cab. Then I leaned forward and touched them together again. The motor turned over, coughed, and the bucket loader took a sudden spasmodic lurch forward. I was thrown into the rudimentary dashboard, the left side of my face striking the steering bar. I'd forgotten to put the damn transmission in neutral and had almost lost an eye as a result. I could almost hear Tink laughing. I fixed that and then tried the wires again. The motor turned over and turned over. It coughed once, puffing a dirty brown smoke signal into the air to be torn away by the ceaseless wind. And then the motor just went on cranking. I kept trying to tell myself that the machine was just in rough shape. A man who'd go off without putting the sand flaps down, after all, was apt to forget anything. But I became more and more sure that they had drained the diesel, just as I had feared. And then, just as I was about to give up and look for something I could use to dipstick the loader's fuel tank, all the better to read the bad news with, my dear, the motor bellowed into life. I let the wires go. The bare patch on the blue one was smoking, and goosed the throttle. When it was running smoothly, I geared it into first, swung it around, and started back towards the long brown rectangle cut neatly into the westbound lane of the highway. The rest of the day was a long, bright hell of roaring engine and blazing sun. The driver of the Case Jordan had forgotten to mount his sand flaps, but he'd remembered to take his sun umbrella. Well, the old gods laugh sometimes, I guess. No reason why. They just do. And I guess the old gods have a twisted sense of humor. It was almost 2 o'clock before I got all of the asphalt chunks down into the ditch, because I'd never achieved any real degree of delicacy with the pinchers. And with the spade-shaped piece at the end, I had to cut it into two and then drag each chunk down the ditch by hand. I was afraid that if I used the pinchers, I would break them. When all the asphalt pieces were down the ditch, I drove the bucket loader back down to the road equipment. I was getting low on fuel. It was time to siphon. I stopped the van, got the hose, found myself staring, hypnotized, at a big jerry can of water. I tossed the siphon away for the time being and crawled into the back of the van. I poured the water over my face and neck and chest and screamed with pleasure. I knew that if I drank I would vomit, but I had to drink. So I did, and I vomited, not getting up to do it, but only turning my head to one side and then crab-crawling as far away from the mess as I could. Then I slept again, and when I woke up it was nearly dusk, and somewhere a wolf was howling at the new moon rising in the purple sky. In the dying light, the cut I had made really did look like a grave. The grave of some mythical ogre, Goliath maybe. "Never," I told the long hole in the asphalt. "Please," Elizabeth whispered back. "Please, for me." I got 4 more emperin out of the glove compartment and swallowed them down. "For you," I said. I parked the Case Jordan with its fuel tank close to the tank of the bulldozer and used a crowbar to pry off the caps on both.
A dozer jockey on a state crew might get away with forgetting to drop the sand flaps on his vehicle, but forgetting to lock the fuel cap in these days of $1.05 diesel? Never. I got the fuel running from the dozer into my loader and waited, trying not to think, watching the moon rise higher and higher in the sky. After a while, I drove back to the cut in the asphalt and started to dig. Running a bucket loader by moonlight was a lot easier than running a jackhammer under the broiling desert sun, but it was still slow work because I was determined that the floor of my excavation should have exactly the right slant. As a consequence, I frequently consulted the carpenter's level I brought with me. That meant stopping the loader, getting down, measuring, climbing up into the peak seat again. No problem ordinarily, but by midnight my body had stiffened up, and every movement sent a shriek of pain through my bones and muscles. My back was the worst. I began to fear that I had done something fairly unpleasant to it. But that, like everything else, was something I would have to worry about later. If a hole 5 feet deep as well as 42 feet long and 5 feet wide had been required, it really would have been impossible, of course, bucket loader or not. I might just as well have planned to send him to outer space, or dropped the Taj Mahal on him. The total yield on such dimensions is over 1,000 cubic feet of earth.
"You've got to create a funnel shape that will suck your bad aliens in," my mathematician friend had said. "And then you've got to create an inclined plane that pretty much mimes the arc of descent."
He drew one on another sheet of graph paper.
"That means that your intergalactic rebels, or whatever they are, only need to remove half as much Earth as the figures initially show. In this case," he scribbled on a worksheet and beamed, 525 cubic feet. Chicken feed. One man could do it."
I had believed so, too, once upon a time, but I had not reckoned on the heat, the blisters, the exhaustion, the steady pain in my back. "Stop for a minute, but not too long. Measure the slant of the trench."
"It's not as bad as you thought, is it, darling? At least it's roadbed and not desert hardpan."
I moved more slowly along the length of the grave as the hole got deeper. My hands were bleeding now as I worked the controls. Ram the drop lever all the way forward until the bucket lay on the ground. Pull back on the drop lever and shove the one that extended the armature with a high hydraulic whine. Watch as the brightly oiled metal slid out of the dirty orange casing, pushing the bucket into the dirt. Every now and then a spark would flash as the bucket slid over a piece of flint. Now raise the bucket. Swivel it, a dark oblong shape against the stars, and try to ignore the steady throbbing pain in your neck the way you're trying to ignore the even deeper throb of the pain in your back, and dump it down in the ditch, covering up the chunks of asphalt already there. "Never mind, darling, you can bandage your hands when it's done. When he's done."
"She was in pieces," I croaked, and jockeyed the bucket back into place so I could take another 200 pounds of dirt and gravel out of Dolan's grave.
How time flies when you're having a good time. Moments after I had noticed the first faint streaks of light in the east, I got down to take another measurement of the floor's incline with my carpenter's level. I was actually near the end. I thought I might just make it. I knelt, and as I did it, I felt something in my back let go. It went with a dull little snap. I uttered a guttural cry and collapsed on my side in the narrow, slanted floor of the excavation, lips pulled back from my teeth, hands pressing into the small of my back. Little by little, the very worst of the pain passed, and I was able to get to my feet. "All right," I thought. "That's it. It's over. It was a good try, but it's over." "Please, darling," Elizabeth whispered back. Impossible as it would have been to believe once upon a time, that whispering voice had begun to take on unpleasant undertones in my mind. There was a sense of monstrous implacability about it. "Please don't give up. Please go on." "Go on digging? I don't even know if I can walk." "But there's so little left to do," the voice wailed. It was no longer just the voice that spoke for Elizabeth, if it had ever been. It was Elizabeth. "So little left, darling."
I looked at my excavation in the growing light and nodded slowly. She was right. The bucket loader was only 5 feet from the end, 7 at most. But it was the deepest 5 or 7, of course, the 5 or 7 with the most dirt in it. You can do it, darling. I know you can. Softly cajoling. But it was not really her voice that persuaded me to go on. What really turned the trick was an image of Dolan lying asleep in his penthouse, while I stood here in this hole beside a stinking, rumbling bucket loader, covered in dirt, my hands in flaps and ruins. Dolan, sleeping in silk pajama bottoms, with one of his blondes asleep beside him, wearing only the top. Downstairs, in the glassed-in executive section of the parking garage, the Cadillac, already loaded with luggage, would be gassed and ready to go. All right, then, I said. I climbed slowly back into the bucket loader's seat and revved the engine. I kept on until 9 o'clock, and then I quit. There were other things to do, and I was running out of time. My angled hull was 40 feet long. It would have to be enough. I drove the bucket loader back to its original spot and parked it. I would need it again, and that would mean siphoning more gas, but there was no time for that now. I wanted more Emprin, but there weren't many left in the bottle, and I would need them all later today. And tomorrow, oh yes, tomorrow, Monday, the glorious 4th. Instead of Emprin, I took a 15-minute rest. I could ill afford the time, but I forced myself to take it just the same. I lay on my back in the van, my muscles jumping and twitching, imagining Dolan. He would be packing a few last-minute items in a travel-all now. Some papers to look over, a toilet kit, maybe a paperback book or a deck of cards. Suppose he flies this time. A malicious voice deep inside me whispered, and I couldn't help it, a moan escaped me. He'd never flown to L.A. before. Always it had been the Cadillac. I had an idea he didn't like to fly. Sometimes he did, though. He'd flown all the way to London once. And the thought lingered, itching and throbbing like a scaly patch of skin. It was 9:30 when I took out the roll of canvas and the big industrial stapler and the wooden struts. The day was overcast and a little cooler. God sometimes grants a favor. Up until then, I'd forgotten my bald head in consideration of larger agonies, but now, when I touched it with my fingers, I drew them away with a little hiss of pain. I looked at it in the outside passenger mirror and saw that it was a deep, angry red, almost a plum color. Back in Vegas, Dolan would be making last-minute phone calls. His driver would be bringing the Cadillac around front. There were only about 75 miles between me and it, and soon the Cadillac would start to close that distance at 60 miles an hour. I had no time to stand around bemoaning my sunburned pate. "I love your sunburned pate, dear," Elizabeth said beside me. "Thank you, Beth," I said and began taking the struts over to the hole. The work was now light compared to the digging I'd done earlier, and the almost unbearable agony in my back subsided to a steady, dull throb. "But what about later?" that insinuating voice asked. "What about that? Hmm?" Later would have to take care of itself, that was all. It was beginning to look as if the trap was going to be ready, and that was the important thing. The struts spanned the hole with just enough extra length to allow me to seat them tightly in the sides of the asphalt which formed the top layer of my excavation. This was a job that would have been tougher at night, when the asphalt was hard, but now, at mid-morning, the stuff was sludgy pliable, and it was like sticking pencils in wads of cooling taffy. When I had all the struts in, the hole had taken on the look of my original chalk diagram, minus the line down the middle. I positioned the heavy roll of canvas next to the shallow end of the hole and removed the hanks of rope that had tied it shut. Then I unrolled 42 feet of Route 71. Close up, the illusion was not perfect, as stage makeup and set decoration is never perfect from the first 3 rows, but even from a few yards away, it was virtually undetectable. It was a dark gray strip which matched the actual surface of Route 71 exactly. On the far left of the canvas strip, as you faced west, was a broken yellow passing line, I settled the long strip of canvas over the wooden understructure, then went slowly along the length of it, stapling the canvas to the struts. My hands didn't want to do the work, but I coaxed them. With the canvas secured, I returned to the van, slid behind the wheel. Sitting down caused another brief but agonizing muscle spasm, and drove back to the top of the rise. I sat there for a full minute, looking down at my lumpy, wounded hands as they lay in my lap. Then I got out and looked back down Route 71, almost casually. I didn't want to focus on any one thing, you see. I wanted the whole picture, a gestalt, if you will. I wanted, as much as possible, to see the scene as Dolan and his men were going to see it when they came over the rise. I wanted to get an idea of how right, or how wrong, it was going to feel to them. What I saw looked better than I could have hoped. The road machinery at the far end of the straight stretch justified the piles of dirt that had come from my excavation. The asphalt chunks in the ditch were mostly buried. Some still showed, the wind was picking up, and it had blown the dirt around, but that looked like the remnants of an old paving job. The compressor I'd brought in the back of the van looked like highway department equipment. And from here, the illusion of the canvas strip was perfect. Route 71 appeared to be utterly untouched down there. Traffic had been heavy Friday and fairly heavy on Saturday. The drone of motors heading into the detour loop had been almost constant. This morning, however, there was hardly any traffic at all. Most people had gotten to wherever they intended to spend the 4th, or were taking the interstate 40 miles south to get there. That was fine by me. I parked the van just out of sight over the brow of the rise and lay on my belly until 10:45. Then, after a big milk truck had gone lumbering slowly up the detour, I backed the van down, opened the rear doors, and threw all the road cones inside. The flashing arrow was a tougher proposition. At first, I couldn't see how I was going to unhook it from the locked battery box without electrocuting myself. Then I saw the plug. It had been mostly hidden by a hard rubber O-ring on the side of the sign case, a little insurance policy against vandals and practical jokers who might find pulling the plug on such a highway sign an amusing prank, I suppose. I found a hammer and chisel in my toolbox, and 4 hard blows were sufficient to split the O-ring. I yanked it off with a pair of pliers and pulled the cable free. The arrow stopped flashing and went dark. I pushed the battery box into the ditch and buried it. It was strange to stand there, hearing it hum down there in the sand. But it made me think of Dolan, and that made me laugh. I didn't think Dolan would hum. He might scream, but I didn't think he would hum. 4 bolts held the arrow in a low steel cradle. I loosened them as fast as I could, ears cocked, for another motor. It was time for one, but not time for Dolan yet, surely. That got the interior pessimist going again. What if he flew? He doesn't like to fly. What if he's driving, but going another way? Going by the interstate, for instance. Today everybody else is. He always goes by 71. Yes, but what if... Shut up! I hissed. Shut up, damn you! Just shut the fuck up! Easy, darling, easy. Everything will be all right.